This Alternative Views program was made during the presidential election campaign of 1988, but not with an establishment candidate.
I really expected that going out into the country, calling myself a socialist, was going to be at least a dangerous thing to do. And the response from people has been altogether unexpected. It's been warm. It's been cordial. People are curious. They really want to know about socialism. They say to me, oh, you're a socialist. I've never met a real live socialist before. Tell me about it.
Just kicked off our fall season. New primetime slot we call The Power of Positive Banking, starring William F. Buckley. It's about a bank president who saves a small crippled chicken from corrupt union officials.
Good. Then you're not whining about social problems.
Oh, believe me, we're not trying to solve anything. This is television.
Keep it up. You're creating a safer bargaining climate every day.
Unemployment is up.
Sad, really. But it keeps the union on their toes. Remember, employed people don't make strikebreakers.
There's a very clear horizontal split in our culture. Hmm. There is the whole culture created by the mass media that we see on network television, read in our newspapers, see in our magazines. And then there's this whole other world, which is the real world of people, where there is a lot of interest in socialist programs, where there's a lot of interest in worker ownership, cooperative buying, cooperative banks, a change in the system, and anger at the glitzy capitalist world they're shown, mm-hmm. which they will never have a part of.
We take a close look at the mass media and then show you an example of what you won't see on the networks, the Socialist Party candidate for president. Right now on Alternative Views. Going to take a look at the mass media on Alternative Views and see what makes them run, both from the outside and the inside. And then we'll show you an example of what you won't see on the networks, an interview with a socialist candidate for President of the United States, Willa Canoyer. In providing the analysis on the mass media, we have two presentations from the Labor Beat program in Chicago. First is a look inside the boardrooms of the networks, and the second is an analysis of the networks as regards the corporate operations and attitudes, particularly toward labor. But now we have some news stories from alternative publications.
Well, when Gorbachev was here, I was thinking, wow, I bet all those gumshoes and spooks are having the time of their life when the head of the Soviet government was in town, and sure enough, according to the Covert Action Information Bulletin, Lewis Wolf found an unnoticed by other media story in UPI on December 10th, 87. And here's what the people did, the CIA and the FBI, it's what they were doing to try to learn more about Gorbachev. The FBI planted dozens of agents who posed in fashionable Madison Hotel as security guards, bellhops, and waiters, and interpreters, and other personnel. Lip readers. They met lip readers who underwent months of training and assignments. Their assignment was to watch Gorbachev, even while, you know, people were even though people were covertly filming Gorbachev. Well, these lip readers, they were supposed to be watching him, and of course now these poor people got to wade through thousands of hours of film and see what Gorbachev was saying. You know, and then the FBI also placed a powerful high-tech shotgun microphone. Right? They had these in every room in Washington where Gorbachev and his aides were going to be staying. And the paraphernalia was so sensitive, the intelligence sources saying that they could pick up Gorbachev's voice even in the middle of an exploding ammunition factory. And they even had psychiatrists working for the FBI Domestic Intelligence Division, and they were supposed to observe Gorbachev's body language, hoping to see how he thinks and makes decisions. Well, Gorbachev is no fool. He and his wife spent the night every night at the Soviet embassy. They weren't going to
be bugged.
Yeah, gosh, the amount of money we spent on that.
Well, evidently the FBI is not the biggest fan of glasnost or better U.S.-Soviet relationships. When San Diego Mayor Maureen O'Connor came up with the idea of hosting a Soviet-American arts festival, she thought that placing the visiting Soviet performers in private homes would be a good step towards international understanding. But according to the Los Angeles Times, the FBI became worried that this is just the kind of thing that will draw Soviet spies bent on befriending and cultivating residents of the United States for espionage purposes. FBI Special Agent Bob Harmon told the Times, "When people know that they're going to be entertaining a Soviet, we'd appreciate a call. We're obviously going to be asking them questions to determine whether or not they're in an intelligence situation." So evidently the FBI probably wants to bug the homes, or at least to debrief all American citizens who are going to be entertaining Soviets. Meanwhile, a very telling letter appeared in TV Guide from some couch potato who wrote, "If we get involved in a nuclear war, would the electromagnetic pulse from exploding bombs damage my videotapes?" The question of the week.
Oh, by the way, did you see, I saw one of those wonderful moments on CNN where they had Reagan at his best. This was at the post-conference media meeting of the networks and all, and as well as the European newspaper people after the NATO conference. And Reagan was sitting up there smiling and, you know, doing his semaphore with his head. And so they said, "President Reagan, what do you, what's your opinion of the final report of the NATO conference?" And he said, "Well, I don't have any thing to say about it because I haven't seen it yet." And one of his aides said, "Oh yes, you did. We showed it to you yesterday." And he said, "Oh well, yes, I have seen it. And he it looks okay." And Reagan said, "Yes, and it looks fine. It looks okay." Yeah. I thought, my God.
Well, you may wonder what the conservatives are up to in the last days of the Reagan administration, and there's an article in The Nation of May the 5th that gives a report on fear and loathing in Washington, on the conservative conclave that took place in March of this year, in which the top conservative activists met in Washington to have a convention, to give speeches, to have dinners, to give out literature, and to peddle their right-wing ideology that they're trying to recycle for the 90s. You could get all sorts of fun things there, like a Impeach Rather bumper sticker, a video cassette of Hanoi Hilton, a Hollywood film about American prisoners in Vietnam that the Accuracy in Media group was giving out. And then if you're worried about the communist threat, you could get a handy reference sheet of license plate prefixes that are assigned to diplomats from the Soviet bloc, so you can spot communist spies outside the 25-mile travel limit from the capital and be able to protect our country. Fawn Hall buttons were selling well. Delegates solemnly were watching videotape replays of Oliver North's Iran-Contra hearings testimonies. There were flyers being handed out everywhere to try to raise money for the Contras. And the grand old man of the Republican Party, Ronald Reagan himself, attended a dinner in his honor. The program for the fete contained a salute to the chief, penned by Lynn Nofziger, who's a former aide who that very day was found guilty of violating the Ethics in Government Act. According to this salute from Nofziger, he wrote, "Reagan is a more principled man than many in his cabinet or staff." And The Nation reports that Nofziger himself has obviously dutifully provided proof of that assertion. The next night at the Banquets Award, Nofziger received a standing ovation. The Republicans evidently don't like these wimpy courts that are trying to throw all of the Reagan administration in jail. Well, for the next couple days, they had their convention, and the main scapegoats
were media, homosexuals, and House Speaker Jim Wright of Texas, who seemed to be the targets of the fear and loathing of the Republican and the New Right delegates there. Accuracy in media and all of the other conservative groups attacked the liberal media as being the main source of this country's problems, spreading disinformation about the Contras, the Soviet Union, Republicans, South Africa, and you name it. They had a panel about how conservatives can get media in a hostile environment. And there was a particular baiting of Sam Donaldson, who the ABC representative who came and was jeered and booed by the delegates there. Well, the other thing that the conservatives are worried about are AIDS, which are, of course, they're blaming on homosexuals and gays, and they're attempting to get all sorts of strict testing and quarantine legislation passed, and we're engaged in quite a bit of gay bashing. One of the conservatives, a woman, gave a speech who was claiming that gays were having a very bad impact on AIDS policy, and she herself received a shock when she informed the gathering that one quarter to one half of the gay population would be dead in 5 years, and at that, a large chunk of the audience stood up and cheered, according to this report. That shows the wonderful humanity and sympathy that conservatives are able to muster up in the face of this great tragedy. Well, the other guy that they ganged up on to bash was Jim Wright, the House leader of Texas. Kenneth Adelman, who is the former director of the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, this is Reagan's number one arms negotiator for many years, delivered a very well-received denunciation of, quote, the nefarious Wright for his behind-the-scenes work on the Central American peace process. Adelman actually came out and said, Wright is a traitor, coaching communists on how to defeat U.S. policy objectives. After he completed the attack, a delegate asked, since the views of our liberal friends match the views of the Communist International, shouldn't we start calling liberals by their true name? And it starts with a C. So anyway, this is what the conservatives are up to. Evidently, there was quite a bit of animosity there concerning who they should support in the presidential election.
Well, that's all the time we have for right now for news from alternative sources. Now let's turn our attention more directly to the mass media and the material provided to us by the producers of Labor Beat, a public access program in Chicago.
In the late 1960s, as a result of economic factors worldwide, U.S. corporations began to consolidate and retrench as never before. Corporations in mass began to reject the concept of social responsibility to the worker or to the social order, and they were aided in this by a conservative climate which they, the corporations, had helped create using television as a linchpin. The increasing conservatism of the federal sector can be seen not as evidence of a new trend in American politics so much as evidence that corporate TV, ever favorable to conservative ideology, has worked hard to create a national media climate favorable to anti-union sentiment. Conservative political groups realized early on that TV had two fundamental criteria: ability to pay and commitment to a pro-corporate ideology. Conservatives qualified on both counts. Conservatives began to develop media strategies of their own to counter pro-labor groups who, conversely, found themselves increasingly excluded from the TV spectrum. The post-war boom years had brought corporations huge profits and created situations which were to be to labor's disadvantage. Multinationals were becoming global in character. Labor unions were not. New computer technology had enabled capital to move at an unheard-of speed. Plant relocation at the touch of a computer terminal became a new bargaining chip in the management union equation. Importantly, corporate public relations strategies and the requisite TV technology available to corporations went far beyond what unions could muster. Labor's access to a public, increasingly subject to corporate media campaigns, was dwindling. In controlling the means and method of production, corporate TV had secured for itself the ability not just to limit debate, but to define it. The results of this for organized labor were clear. Nationally, unions began to be defined as either corrupt, inept, or both. A negative, TV-promoted worker stereotype began to appear, simultaneous with conservative attempts to define the American worker as a hard hat and de facto member of the silent majority. If the majority were silent, television had had a great deal to do with keeping them that way. Unions were presented as out of fashion, unproductive, and themselves anti-labor. In areas where labor had a strong base, unions were stigmatized as being in bed with the company. Most importantly, labor issues, strikes in particular, were no longer newsworthy, or they received limited and often negative coverage. TV newsreaders, many of whom even on the local level are paid in six figures, can hardly be seen as likely candidates for pro-labor sentiment. But TV, in the midst of all of this, had the additional task of appearing objective. Here again, public relations had some well-prepared tactics available. Simulated debate with well-rehearsed and sometimes well-paid participants. The public impression was one of give and take, but the reality was a completely prepared one. In-house critics became a TV standard. Television had begun to sell its ability to criticize itself. TV also began to promote its journalistic image, a throwback to print media days, though the reality was something else again. Despite all of this, even conservative proponents of the media admitted that there was less hard news now than ever before, as even TV news programs began to look to show business to up ratings. Longtime advocates of TV journalism, like Fred W. Friendly at CBS, disgusted with what they saw happening, left the networks behind and became extremely critical of the system, albeit from the outside. FCC Commissioner Newton Minow coined the vast wasteland phrase, which has since become a part of the national vocabulary. Minow was describing TV at a time when, compared with what has occurred, TV was in its infancy. Minow's point was that the corporate hold on television was not in the public interest. Today's situation goes far beyond what Minow feared. There had been hope that public television would provide an antidote. The antidote has since proven to be even more a corporate tool than the networks had been. Staffed, financed by corporate grants, and managed by corporate boards, themselves drawn from major corporations, public television has proven itself corporate TV's poorer, if more articulate, friend. But corporate TV has its problems. Video cassettes, ratings wars, dwindling audiences, proxy battles, falling stock shares, and viewer dissatisfaction all point to the growing contradictions within television itself. Organized labor found itself increasingly isolated and now began to contend with the possibility that America's management labor problems had been turned over to corporate television for solution. If television and the media were really, as they themselves said, in the information business, just whose information were they talking about? It had also become clear that organized labor constituted television's unwanted audience. For TV, audience desirability had become a matter of advertiser receptivity. Television strategy held that audiences were determined by age and by income. But as one TV advertiser put it, we're not just selling a product, we're selling a way of life. It was a way of life uninterested in low-income groups, the aged, or organized labor. Labor began to see conservative candidates for local and national office receive disproportionate media attention. Candidates were made aware, often by media consultants with corporate backgrounds, that anti-labor positions and programs got immediate and extensive TV coverage, while pro-labor sentiment just did not play. Some previously pro-labor politicians were quick to get the message. Political campaigns are now totally dependent on what TV coverage they can muster. It is the prime factor. Labor's candidates weren't getting heard, and when they were heard, the results were negative. TV has the power to edit, and that can also mean confuse and distort what a candidate has to say. Leading questions, which presuppose an answer, omission of relevant material, the carefully chosen TV expert, whose response is quite predictably TV safe, assignments editors carefully schooled to the conservative choice, are essential components of television production today. Given the situation we describe, The results at the polls have been unsurprising. The only remaining question for organized labor became, how soon will we be looking at a wave of anti-labor legislation and sentiment? The answer was not long in coming. Reaganomics was to be carefully geared to the demands of corporate television.
Well, that's an analysis of corporate TV from an outsider. Here's what the Labor Beat people have shown as what they think goes on inside the boardroom.
We've got union contract negotiations coming up, and I have prepared a list of possible issues here.
Issues? Issues. I'm concerned with the corporate picture, not issues. What are we doing on television?
Just kicked off our fall season. New primetime slot we call The Power of Positive Banking, starring William F. Buckley. It's about a bank president who saves a small crippled chicken from corrupt union officials.
Good. Then you're not whining about social problems.
Oh, believe me, we're not trying to solve anything. This is television.
Keep it up. You're creating a safer bargaining climate every day.
Unemployment is up.
Sad, really. But it keeps the union on their toes. Remember, employed people don't make strike breakers.
Usual vague talk of a recession.
Recession. Let's emphasize that with the union, but not with the stockholders.
Right.
Clear on that?
Mm-hmm. In summing up, corporate television creates a daily picture of aggression and conflict in a world increasingly divided between haves and have-nots.
Don't forget, with happy talk, have and have-nots. You know, the greatest motivator I know is fear. Keeps that workforce motivated.
Right. Fear. I've been wondering, what did courage, bravery, and self-sacrifice lead to anyway?
Labor unions.
Union may raise the question of job security.
I get very insecure when job security doesn't come up. By the way, how are we doing with our Buy America campaign?
Great. We've just reordered more T-shirts, posters, and 1,500 new Buy American bumper stickers from our plant in Taiwan.
Any new acquisitions?
Well, all four TV stations showing a profit. Of course, there is a conflict of interest question.
Conflict of interest? This corporation does not interfere with TV network policy. We make it. Where's the conflict?
Have to ask the Justice Department on that one. But confidentially, I don't think the Justice Department is interested in conflict of interest anymore.
Yeah. The Rehnquist appointment. He's a team player. Our team. Now, where were we?
Conflict of interest.
No. Americans have been traditionally hostile to big business. Why? Not long ago, there was talk of federal legislation, nationalizing industry. Why do you think we're doing better? Do you think it's some sort of trick?
Trick?
The unions.
Well, according to our records, the Carter administration, with advice from major corporations, got the America is no longer competitive campaign going. Immediate media barrage about cutting costs, bailing out the economy. Corporate TV went to work and got positive results.
Results?
People got confused and scared.
You don't get concessions without anxiety.
Well, 1982 and 1983, undocumented workers and illegal alien situation. Again, corporate TV put workers on guard about job security, and the American corporation did what it could to solve the situation.
What did we do?
Helped stem the flow of Mexican workers into America.
How?
We built a non-union plant in Mexico and got concessions here.
Right.
1984-85, it was health care and insurance benefits, and a lot more television analysis by corporate networks dependent on corporate advertising.
Result?
Absolute climate of anxiety and insecurity among working people.
Create a menace, promote it. and then watch corporate TV create a kind of mass insecurity. Now that's what I call corporate entertainment.
TV is the key, but this paranoia is affecting job performance, families, children.
But not the bottom line. Look, we're not in the garment business or cars or steel. Let's not make that mistake. We're in the money business. Remove that fear factor and I'd be afraid. Remember, fear can move mountains. Remember what self-sacrifice and courage led to?
Labor unions.
Imagine a workforce completely employed, unafraid, unhampered by the threat of economic crisis or recession.
We've always had economic crisis and recession.
My point is, would you want to live in a world like that?
Speaking as a labor relations executive, no.
Exactly. Now, where were we?
Let's see. Job security, worker insecurity, talk recession, get concession, the unemployed as potential strike breakers, media equals climate of fear.
Not good enough. This time around, I want a new menace. Something that is going to be around for a while. Something that corporate television has an investment in. Something that's not going to get blown out of prime time.
Menace. National issue. Peace.
We're going for more defense contracts. It's not a menace issue. Worse, it's a non-profit issue. Worse, it's a union issue. Do you know how much the American taxpayer has paid for weapon systems?
Billions.
Exactly, billions. And do you know what Reagan is planning? Think of the future. Think of the future.
That's what the unions say.
It's not the same future.
Right.
Now, I want something that we can use at the bargaining table, and I want a menace that will force union workers down on both sides of the issue.
Menace.
Right, menace.
Right, something like seniority. A few years back, older workers versus younger workers. Now that created insecurity, tension, and intimidation.
Precisely. A healthier bargaining climate.
Well, the healthiest new development for us seems to be drugs.
Drugs? I don't know. Look what happened to DeLorean. Just trying to make a buck the best way he knew how, and they jumped all over.
Drug abuse testing programs.
Testing programs.
It's the new menace. Fits the fear profile.
National threat outlined in presidential talk. That's from Time. Government and business unite to defend the public interest. Wall Street Journal. And we'll be covering it on corporate TV. And it just might create
chaos. This is the one we've been waiting for.
We try out the drug abuse testing programs in the non-union plants. Then we get some TV coverage from ourselves. And then we spring it on the union.
Not bad. People will be peeing all over America. Only Ronald Reagan could have come up with this one.
Union people won't just be coming down on both sides of the issue. They will also be encouraged to inform on each other.
Informing? I haven't heard that kind of talk since the 50s. Informing. Now that's the kind of worker solidarity we haven't seen around here in a long time.
Real question is, how do we sell it? There is a constitutional issue here. Rights of the individual endangered.
Well, it's your job to come up with the answers. How do you sell a potentially unconstitutional issue?
From a public relations standpoint, you don't sell it.
Right. It should not look like advertising. The advertising department will write the campaign. But it's not advertising. Clear?
Clear.
So if it's not advertising, but the advertising department writes and markets the campaign for the corporation, what do you call it?
corporate-sponsored public service announcements. It's in the public's interest to get the information from the corporation.
All their information.
And the public service aspect improves corporate image and gets the point across without advertising.
There isn't a union out there that can get to a national TV audience the way we can.
They can't afford it.
Democracy in action. Hmm. Now, about these commercials.
Public service announcements.
Right. Let's go right for the jugular with them. Patriotism. Hard sell.
Encourage.
Right. Hard encourage. We'll wave the flag in their faces. Let them try to put Old Glory down. We need a slogan.
Tough. Urine tests. How about pass the bottle?
Pass the bottle.
Pass the bottle for America.
What was it you said?
About what?
Television.
Oh, yes. Corporate television creates a daily picture of aggression and conflict in a world increasingly divided between haves and have-nots.
With happy talk. It's a world of unemployment, recession, worker insecurity,
disinvestment, urban crime, arms races, violence.
Tragic, really.
It's not a pretty picture.
When this man goes to work, America's in trouble. The Rust Corporation urges you to support drug abuse testing programs in your community and on the job. Remember, pass the bottle for America.
Our thanks to the Committee for Labor Access and the Media Process Group people in Chicago for letting us use their material this evening. Now here's something you won't see on the networks.
Our guest today is Willa Knoyer, who is the presidential candidate of the Socialist Party USA. Willa is currently traveling around the country campaigning and is in Texas this week and has stopped by the Alternative Views studio. So thank you for coming by, Willa. We're glad to have you with us today.
Delighted to be here.
We'd like to begin talking about your campaign. Could you please tell us what you're running on, what the platform and goal of the campaign is?
Well, the Socialist Party campaign this year is based on the platform written in convention last May, the convention where I was nominated. According to party rules, we can't even nominate a candidate until we have a platform. The platform was written by the membership, and it's broken into four main parts: human rights, human needs, ecology, economy, and foreign relations. We're demanding immediately a federally funded national health care program. We want federally funded child care. We want free education lifelong. We want low-income housing immediately. We want a full employment economy. Under the economy, we want to see the warfare budget shifted to peacetime use. We want to see the climate or the planet cleaned up. We would like to have, we want clean air and clean water. We want a correction of the evils that we've done before, and certainly the conversion from the war industry would include a lot of ecological cleanup programs. And we are a socialist party. We're looking for a fundamental change in the way the country is run, away from the more or less capitalist system that we have now. We want a system that's based on worker control of industry, and for people, not profits. Remember, Debs, whom Eugene V. Debs, whom we call our founder, said, "I am socialist because I am for humanity," and that's still our theme and still the basis of our platform.
And this, I take it, would distinguish you from the Democratic Party that might agree with some of the ideas in your platform. What then would be your criticism of the Democrats as a party?
The Democratic Party is still a capitalist party. It's still beholden to the major corporations in this country. The candidates get their money from big money people. They aren't looking for any real change in ownership of industry anywhere in the system. The system would stay the same. It would stay basically for profit. It would still put workers in the position of not being able to set the price for their labor, as a worker-controlled economy could do. It basically serves profit, which is finally what we see as the problem with the system as it exists.
And how would a socialist economy be organized differently? What are the basic ideas you have for socialism?
The basic ideas that the Socialist Party USA discusses are under the framework of worker control of the major means of production. We talk about a decentralized system. We talk about a market economy, mixed economy. Small businesses would still exist. After all, small businesses in this country have created, 115% of the new jobs over the last years, working hard to pick up the jobs that corporations are destroying. But fundamentally, that's the economy, a cooperative, decentralized, worker and consumer-controlled economy.
So you're talking about some capitalism in your system still exists, but it's just not the big monopoly capitalism
that we have now. That basically is how the platform reads out, and that's how it's written.
And what sorts of nationalization programs would you have? Would you socialize some of the big industries? If so, which ones?
And the banking system?
The banking system for sure would be socialized. Energy would be socialized. These are very important industries to be socialized. There are natural monopolies such as the telephone company, which really does belong as a socialized system.
You know, in Europe there are socialist governments or socialist parties which are, quote, in power, but the capitalist economic system still is the same, and they do the bidding of the capitalist system, imposing austerity on the workers, etc. And they find that if they try to do anything more fundamental, then the capitalist international economic system will make sure that that country will suffer the consequences. How would you be able to do the things you would like to do without really running into some terrible, terrible repercussions?
Well, there's always been terrible, terrible repercussions when socialists have tried to change the economies. And I'm afraid it's just going to happen. Although, you know, there's been a lot of socialist changes. In our own society, there are many things about our present system that are socialist that we take for granted. For example, Social Security and Medicare, although we certainly don't have an adequate medical system, workers' compensation, unemployment insurance. These were all part of Norman Thomas's platform.
Taken over by Roosevelt in the New Deal. And institutionalized to save capitalism, basically, during the Depression.
And which certainly made socialism suffer after the Depression. Mm. Quinn Brisbane, our 1976 vice presidential candidate, compares the fortunes of the Socialist Party with those of pawn shops. Now, we do well when the pawn shops do well. We do well in bad economic situations.
Well, it looks like bad economic situations are on the horizon with the growing deficit, with deindustrialization and loss of jobs. What would be a socialist program for the deficit? How would you deal with this problem?
Well, for example, we talk about conversion of the warfare economy. There are many, many parts of the public sector that need work. Back to the ecology, back to the toxic waste dumps we've got, back to the poisoning of the Great Lakes. The biggest body of fresh water on the planet is dying. Lake Superior is almost hopelessly polluted at this point. There is a lot of cleanup work to be done. One of my favorite shticks is rebuilding the railroads. Mm. We really do need mass public transportation, and we need mass shipping. Mm. There are lots of places labor-intensive industries where the money that's being put into capital-intensive work economies mm-hmm. could create jobs, could contribute to the circulation of money, mm-hmm. could make life a whole lot better for a whole lot of other people without building guns. Now, as the Greenham Common women say, guns can never defend you, they can only destroy you.
Still, you would have to operate even under conditions of economic conversion with this deficit. Would you socialize the deficit, so to speak, by nationalizing some of the banks and then just canceling the debt burden? I mean, that's one idea.
That has been thrown around. I'm not enough of an economist mm-hmm. to give you a flat answer on that. Mm-hmm. But yes, I have seen that argument. There's a lot of ways. There are a lot of economists arguing different ways to wipe out the deficit by declaring that it doesn't exist.
Of course, now a lot of people say we do have socialism in the United States, socialism for the rich, because the government is controlled and run for them and by them, and they reap the benefits.
So I certainly agree with that.
Part of the economy, part of the people in the United States are under that socialist system.
I would certainly agree with that. And we have other socialist things, such as an army, which is socialist. The police department and the fire departments are socialist.
The army is welfare for men, in the words of a friend of mine.
Good answer.
You know, it was so curious. Back when I was in the Navy for a long time, and I heard a chief petty officer giving a reenlistment a talk to some young sailors, and he's saying, think of all the benefits you have. You have, you know, you can go to all these schools for free. We have all this free medical attention. You don't have to worry about anything. You have job security. And then maybe about a half hour later, I heard him talking politics. He was talking about socialized medicine. Those Democrats want socialized medicine. They want free education. I said, wait a minute, Chief. You were just talking about how great it is in the Navy. You've got all these socialized things, and most people don't realize that.
When I was talking to a high school group in Barrie, Vermont, a couple of weeks ago, there was a young man who said that he was going to join the military and protect his country. And the girl sitting next to him said, no, you're not. You're going to join the Army and have a good time because you can't find a job here in town.
Can we take a look at the history of the Socialist Party? Those of us who have gone to high school and college, and we've all read about the Socialist Party, Eugene V. Debs and Norman Thomas. The Socialist Party was very strong at one time, particularly in the Midwest and here in Texas. And Debs got over 1 million votes for a national election one year. What has happened? Why is it so small? How many votes, for instance, did the Socialist Party get to the last go-around?
The last go-around in 1980, when David McReynolds and Dionne Rufenbrock ran, the party was only on the ballot in 10 states, I believe. And the vote, they got something like 6,900 votes.
So what has happened over the years?
Well, there's been a lot of obstacles for all third parties, all alternative parties to overcome. I think socialism has had a rougher go. The party was formed, of course, by Eugene Debs. We call his name up most. Mother Jones was one of the founders of the party. After his radicalization in the Pullman strikes in Chicago in the late 90s, and the oldest continuously existing socialist party in the U.S. is the Socialist Labor Party, founded by Daniel DeLeon in the 80s. The Socialist Party of America broke off in what I've read as a non-doctrinal split. I'm not really quite sure what it meant. In 1900, and Debs then ran five times for president on the ticket. In 1912, he took his largest number of votes. There were the 6% of the popular vote in that year. There were 1,200 socialist party holders elected in that year, congressmen, local government officials throughout the country. And the party remained strong, really, and effective into the 20s. Debs himself was broken when he was arrested in 1919 and imprisoned for opposing World War I. And he ran for president in 1920 on the slogan, the pin says, vote for prisoner 9653. And he took 990,000 votes. But that was the beginning of the end for Debs. He was never well again. He died in 1926. There was a large anti-red push. Well, the Communist Party then split off in, was it 1919? And there was a major split in the Socialist Party, because the Socialist Party of America didn't want to take the Bolshevik line, and the communists did, and that was a major division. It's a division, apparently, that there was a great deal of bitterness about, and bitterness that has remained between the two parties, unfortunately.
They're still at each other's throats even today, are they not?
Well, I'll tell you a little story about that, because occasionally they do work in coalition, and every time they catch themselves at it, they laugh and say, what are we doing working together? This is ridiculous. But sometimes it happens in special circumstances. Anyhow, Debs died in 1926. Norman Thomas ran for the first time in 1928, ran six times for president. There were some major changes in the party then. And then more recently, there was another split in the party the Trotskyists split away in 1937. That was the Socialist Workers' Party, which gives us another one of the socialist parties in the country. And then the Socialist Party of America underwent another major split in 1973 over the Vietnam War. Part of the membership wanted to stay with the labor union base that Debs had built, and the unions tended to be a little hawkish on the war. There was another group that called itself the Debs Caucus that remained an anti-war party, and there was a third group whose major thrust was anti-communism. And after it all shook out, the Socialist Party USA is the old Debs Caucus, the anti-war group. Michael Harrington led the pro-union group, which became Democratic Socialists of the Democratic Socialist Organizing Committee, and now Democratic Socialists of America, and they work entirely inside the Democratic Party.
Right.
And then the third group was the Social Democrats USA, and they've continued on a rightward trajectory to the point where they're working in the Reagan administration now. But their big thing was their anti-communism.
How big a factor was the two Red Scares in the United States, the McCarthy period, and then the first one back in
the Palmer Raids,
1900s.
Yeah. There are volumes written, or libraries written, on the effect of those events, and I think they must have been very severe. My memory goes back to the McCarthy days, but not as a socialist. But my strong perception is now that much of that has been forgotten. That the scare, the frightening of the McCarthy days, and people are far more comfortable with socialism again. I really expected that going out into the country, calling myself a socialist, was going to be at least a dangerous thing to do. And the response from people has been altogether unexpected. It's been warm. It's been cordial. People are curious. They really want to know about socialism. They say to me, oh, you're a socialist. I've never met a real-life socialist before. Tell me about it. And I've been very pleased that the response has been as kind, as receptive.
Have people now, do you think, begun to distinguish between communism and socialism? Generally, during the McCarthy period, all leftists were put into one category, communists, of which a lot of liberals were thrown in also, mm-hmm. as being agents of the Soviet Union, part of a monolithic world communist conspiracy. Have people gotten over that, do you think, and they now can see that there's differences between socialism and communism, or do you still experience some of the same misunderstandings and basically just ignorance about the history we've just been talking about?
Great ignorance, mm-hmm. which is continuously promoted by the popular media, mm-hmm. who don't distinguish between any models of socialism anywhere. It's all one big red scare. No, people ask a lot about the difference between mm-hmm. socialism and communism and are willing to listen, but they do ask because most people are confused. Mm-hmm. And I do explain that, you know, that we are the Socialist Party of the USA. Mm-hmm. We are a democratic, bottom-up party. We are governed by the members. The leadership does as it's instructed by the membership, whereas communism, using the Soviet model, is a system run from the top down by a small cadre in a single-party system. And, in fact, communism and socialism, using those models, are the reverse of each other.
Plus, you as Socialist Party USA have a long tradition in the United States, whereas the Communist Party is mostly offspring of Bolshevik Russian parties coming out of the Russian Revolution.
Yeah, specifically Bolshevik, and
right.
we've always refused to have anything to do with the Bolshevik line. The Socialist Party comes, as we were discussing earlier, from a long tradition mm-hmm. of communes, of socialist experiments in the United States, going right. Going back long before Marx.
And that's right. People usually think that socialism started with Marx, whereas, as you said, the various socialist experiments started before that. What is the relationship between the Socialist Party and Marx or Marxism?
Well, there are Marxists in the party, but we are not a Marxist party. I'm not a Marxist, mostly because I've never gotten around to reading it, to be truthful with you. But that's the distinction. There are Marxists in the party.
And as you've been traveling around the United States and been getting what you just said was a good response to your socialist program, which ideas do you think people are most receptive to that you found?
There are two big ones that I'm delighted with. Nobody blinks when I talk about a national health care program. Nobody blinks when I talk about federally funded child care. Those are obviously two issues whose time has come. And if Orrin Hatch can acknowledge that we need child care, obviously it's, you know, it's penetrated pretty deeply into the culture.
So you think people might in the 1990s and then in the next century be ready for more of a mixed economy where there's more of a redefinition between the public and the private sector? Under Reagan, we were getting the ideology that everything in the public sector was bad, that only the private sector could take care of all of our needs, etc. I think this has proved to be manifestly false. So do you think as we move into the 90s, people will open themselves to more ideas that some public sector programs like socialized medicine, like daycare, like education, for that matter, for everyone, are good ideas?
I'm convinced of it. Mm-hmm. You know, in some ways, this is the most subversive campaign, and I have learned such interesting things by running it, because I'm not covered by the major media. I'm not on the freeways of the campaign, as a reporter once commented. But I'm talking to a lot of people who are very responsive, and I've been aware the last month, especially because I've been on the road a lot, that there's a very clear horizontal split in our culture. Mm. There is the whole culture created by the mass media that we see, you know, on network television, read in our newspapers, see in our magazines, and then there's this whole other world, which is the real world of people, where there is a lot of interest in socialist programs, where there's a lot of interest in worker ownership, cooperative buying, cooperative banks, a change in the system, and anger at the glitzy capitalist world they're shown, mm-hmm. which they will never have a part of. But there's a very clear horizontal split, I think.
And have the major media paid any attention to your campaign? Have you gotten any coverage on the networks or New York Times or Time or Newsweek?
The New York Times announced the nomination last June, mm-hmm. or last May. I've had good local press coverage here in Austin. Some fairly big city newspapers have broken down and run stories. I have received mention on television, not on the network, certainly.
So it's been mostly local media
All local.
That have given you a fair shake and
yeah.
coverage.
What about CNN or...
Haven't had any response from them at all, because we're not major party candidates. And there are lots of the media. It's not just the socialists that don't get mm-hmm. touched. The libertarians don't get any press either.
Too.
It's all of us who are not Republicans and Democrats.
That all third parties' candidates seem to be out of the picture as far as the networks are concerned.
And it's not just a question of neglect. Yeah. When you get to discussing ballot access laws state by mm-hmm. state, it is a contrived, conscious, legislated closing of doors against third parties.
Mm-hmm. In addition to this, a lot of people would say that the two parties are really both establishment parties, but there is just a single party system with split in two, controlled by the same people up at the top.
And you know, and it becomes very clear that we have a single party system after an event like Super Tuesday, when Bush has virtually been declared the Republican winner. And if you're Republican with any other preference, you're out of the picture.
It's already been decided.
It's already been decided. The Democratic proportional system leaves a little bit more contest, but much of that is decided too.
Mm-hmm. What is your perception so far of the Democratic side? What do you think of, for instance, Jackson and Dukakis? Do they offer anything of a progressive alternative?
I don't think Dukakis is progressive at all. Mm-hmm. I hate to pick up a catchword out of the popular press and call him a technocrat. But no, I don't think he's progressive at all. And having been in Massachusetts the last couple of weeks, I'm not wildly impressed by the recovery there, the much-vaunted recovery. Jackson's another case altogether. I am personally delighted that Jackson is saying the things he's saying. Mm-hmm. I am also grieved that he's only leading people back into the Democratic Party and that the Rainbow Coalition doesn't have any long-term plan for changing the system. Mm. And that's physically painful because Jackson potentially could do so much and he is attracting so many people, but he's leading them back into the very party that's oppressed them. And there's no future in that. There's no real change for people in that.
So you see the Democratic Party basically as a dead end, and the only real alternative for progressive change being a third-party movement outside of the system of the Democrats and Republicans.
Yes, I feel that very strongly. I think the Democratic Party has shown itself again and again to be a dead end. And unless we can get strength outside the two major parties and shake it up a little bit, we're going to go on the same road we're on forever.
Yet the problem has been there just hasn't been a third party that's emerged in the last couple decades since the demise of the socialist and the communist parties as major forces in U.S. politics. In the 1960s, there was a large anti-war movement, but it never really translated into a political party. There's been the Citizens Party. Your socialist parties have attempted to get a movement going.
Libertarians
as third parties. Do you think there's any prospects that a left third party might emerge?
That is a subject that I've given a lot of thought to. I was active in the Citizens Party before I joined the Socialist Party. I was active in the Citizens Party when I joined the Socialist Party. I joined the Socialist Party because it has a clear philosophy and a history. Mm-hmm. It knows where it's going. And I think that's been the problem with most of the third party movements. They don't have a clear ideology, a clear direction. The Socialist Party has that. I don't know that we will be the emerging party, mm-hmm. but I think that any party that does emerge to challenge the system will have to come from a clear ideological and philosophical base, right, such as socialism.
Well, we have time for one last news story.
In the Times reports that when Lorillard, Inc. introduced Kent cigarettes in 1952, it promised that its unique micronite filter provided the greatest health protection in cigarette history. This magic ingredient was alleged by the advertising hype to be pure, dust-free, completely harmless material. Guess what the micronite filter consisted of?
Oh,
asbestos, which has later become revealed to be one of the major carcinogenic substances there is. And that's what Kent used in their cigarette filters for many years.
That brings us to the end of another Alternative Views, number 354 to be exact. Alternative Views is a production of the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. You want to jot that down and drop us a line? We'd be glad to hear from you. Goodbye.